Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. He's here. Everybody knows him as the publisher of the president of the most important publishing house in the Alpha Quadrant, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press here. Open forum. You can call him, ask him, and ask him anything you want. 888-318-7884. Hello, Mark Brumley.
Hey, how are you doing? The new Catholic Answers, I almost said Ignatius Press, the new Catholic Answers best-selling author.
I'm doing very well. I am the best-selling author of all the radio hosts currently employed here. I am the highest-selling currently employed radio host.
Well, we were just talking about your new book, and tell people the title of your new book.
Oh, no, I couldn't, Mark. All right, A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him.
It's better than A Strange Teacher of Things.
That's true. But although some of the things that he does, we would identify as strange because strange in the technical sense that especially if we had a tendency towards any kind of materialism. Well, it's strange when someone can cast out demons and heal people with a word. That is very strange behavior.
That is. I was telling you before we went on the air that we Ignatius Press are distributing the book as well.
Thank you.
So, but of course we want people to go to catholic.com and purchase it there. But if they happen to be at the ignatius.com site already, we want them to feel like they can purchase your book from us.
I appreciate you saying that. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't care where they buy it. I just buy it. buy it early, buy it often, buy lots of copies. Thanks, Mark.
There we go.
Thanks. Usually we start off by talking about an Ignatius Press book, and I hope you will have something you want to tell me about. But thank you for giving me a chance to talk about my contribution.
Well, we have a great companion volume or set of companion volumes. You know, we do the Benedict XVI, Jesus of Nazareth books.
Yes, so right.
Those are great companion volumes to your book, which is very popular and accessible, but you want to go a little deeper in terms of the teaching and the historical background of Jesus. The Jesus of Nazareth books by Pope Benedict are good. And we just came out with a book by a fellow named Michael Hesseman called Jesus of Nazareth, Archaeologists.
Oh, I love that book.
The title, Retracing the Footsteps of Jesus. So that goes more into the archaeology. So there are a lot of great Jesus books out there, and I am just delighted that you have added to list.
I feel like somewhere in there you suggested that Pope Benedict was a deeper thinker than I am. I feel like somewhere in there the suggestion was made.
I think you're both deep thinkers.
Oh, yeah,
I just
we are.
Think
okay.
he had three volumes to
That's
cover,
true.
You know.
Right.
You cover in a single, relatively short, accessible paperback. So.
Right. And then the near presence of the Holy Spirit as well as pontiff of the Roman Church. Not that.
No, and I think he's 93 years old, so he's had a few years to get a head start on you.
Yeah. I love his books. And, the funniest title of any of his books, and I know that there's many comic titles, Introduction to Christianity. Because you're like, this is the introduction? What's advanced Christianity like?
Yes, if this is 101, what's 401, or 404 or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. That it's funny that you mention that book because people will often ask me, where's a good place to start with Ratzinger? And there are a lot of, depending on the people and what their interest is, there are lots of places you can start. I have, from time to time, recommend to start with Introduction to Christianity. It's a challenging book from a certain perspective, but it's immensely worthwhile. I think I may have told the story on Catholic Answers Live, but I know I tell it all the time in other contexts. When I first, seriously exploring Catholicism now, so I'm actually, reading Louis Bouilliet's Spirit and Forms of Protestantism, Carl Adam's A Spirit of Catholicism, just like serious, so I'm, probably 19 years old when I'm doing this, right? So I get Introduction to Christianity. It wasn't published by Ignatius Press because Ignatius Press was just coming online at that time, but it had been published back in the late 60s. I'm not real clear. I don't remember now who the publisher of that. I remember the actual book cover and all that. But anyway, so I picked up this book. And I kind of had the reaction that you described as, this is the introduction. I what am I going to do when it gets deeper? I had no idea what that man was talking about. But, you know, then I read other things and I underwent, you know, a conversion. I became a Catholic. And I won't say that then when next time I picked it up, it was easy to understand. But I will say it was profoundly rewarding.
Yes.
The challenges. Oh, that,
right.
It was profoundly rewarding. So right. I would encourage, you know, Catholics to read Introduction to Christianity by Joseph Ratzinger.
Yeah.
It's just a great work of 20th century Catholic theology.
I think of it as a great follow-up to A Teacher of Strange Things, who Jesus was, what he taught, and why people still follow him. A great follow-up. There's so many. He's such a generous mind, too. I never get over his chapter on belief in God there and how generous he is to atheists there in saying, well, atheists and Christians have the same problem. We don't know. You know, and there's just so much that we don't know. And,
right.
and to be like that, he finds a way to be kind of in solidarity with people you think are our opponents. But no, it was not. We're not. We share so much, including an overwhelming amount of ignorance.
Right. Well, there's a great conversation about the nature of belief and the nature of doubt and belief and versus knowledge. And of course, the atheist, in fact, has a kind of faith. He has a faith that there is no God.
Right.
You know, and so as Ratzinger points out there, you know, he's constantly faced with, quotes, the temptation to believe that there is actually a larger meaning to the universe, you know.
Right.
When, and of course, the believer in the proper sense, in the Christian committed believer, is of course tempted to not believe in God or not trust in God and so on. So they are, as you say, kind of in a similar boat,
right.
but the believer, then this is often the case, and Ratzinger often makes this point, and Chesterton and C.S. Lewis make the point as well, that the believer can account for what the believer does and what the atheist does. The atheist has a problem accounting for the believer, and he has a problem consistently living out
atheism. Right. Yep.
So,
yeah. Introduction to Christianity. It's open forum. We've already got a bunch of lines full. There's two lines open if you want to call with your question for Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, the most important press in the entire Alpha Quadrant, 888-318-7884. The number. So I'll give you a choice, Mark. We can go to the phones or we can continue talking about A Teacher of Strange Things.
Why do as much as I'd love talking about your book, why don't we go to the phone?
You don't want to talk about me anymore? Okay, fine.
No, we'll work you in, you know.
We'll work me in. I like that. All right. Mitch, we'll try to make it seem natural. Mitch in Wisconsin, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Glad to have you, Mitch. Go ahead and start us off with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi. So my question deals with something I noticed in the Roman canon and also in like the offertory prayers in the extraordinary form. And that's that it almost seems like there's two sacrifices going on. The first one being like the offering of the bread and the wine to God. And the priest says, you know, we offer you these gifts, these offerings, these holy and unblemished sacrifices. And it almost seems, especially in the extraordinary form, that the bread and the wine themselves are actually being offered in reparation to God. But then after consecration, it seems like then it's the sacrifice of Christ. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, is it all really one sacrifice or what's sort of going on there? Like, how can it be said that the bread and the wine are in themselves sacrifices?
Good question. And you're touching on a very complicated, well, you're touching on a simple theological issue that has complicated elements to it. But essentially, there is a sense in which the bread and wine that we bring, we the faithful, and obviously, you know, the faithful at your typical parish aren't, you know, it's not like the bread was baked by my wife and she's bringing it up, or the wine was made by, you know, my cousin Louis out in the vineyard and we're bringing those things up. No, but through the purchase of these resources through the gift of the parishioners in the parish, we have the elements of bread and wine that are offered to God. They are in themselves offerings that we make to God. And what's an offering? When we take from the gifts that we've received from God, some portion of those gifts as representing the whole of what we've received from God. So the bread and wine that we bring to the Eucharistic celebration, these are tokens of the gift of our whole selves. Just the bread and the wine, the elements of, that become the Eucharistic sacrifice themselves, have this element of offering or gift to God from among all of the many gifts that he gives us. And so what happens? Well, the God gives us these gifts. We give back as a token of the totality of his gifts. We give them back. And what does he do? He transforms them into the real gift, the true gift, the gift that makes all other gifts possible, the gift of his Son. He transforms these gifts and makes them truly worthy offerings to give to God. And by doing that, enables us truly to offer ourselves in a worthy way, worthy by virtue of our repentant communion. That's a phrase I'm using more and more. Our repentant communion with the gift that Christ offers. What do I mean by that? Well, we know that none of us is ever really worthy to associate what we do with what Jesus did on the cross 2,000 years ago and what he continues to do in the Eucharistic sacrifice as the risen, glorified Lord, namely give himself to the Father out of total self-giving love. None of us is worthy to do that. So how do we participate in that in a worthy way, echoing back to what St. Paul says about a worthy participation in the Eucharist that isn't a profanation of the Eucharist, not a profanation of the body and blood of Christ. The answer is we do it by virtue of repentant faith. When we are repentant and we participate in the Eucharist, then the Eucharistic sacrifice that Christ offers the Father, we become participants in. So yes, there is in a certain way a twofold sacrifice there. There is the gifts that we bring of these earthly elements of bread and wine, it's true that the bread is the work of human hands and the fruit of the vine, the work of human hands, and with respect to the wine. These are we've taken God's gifts and we've fashioned them and made them sort of human things, but we're giving them back to God as acknowledging everything comes from him. But because he's able to transform them, this sacrifice that we make gets elevated into the Trinitarian gift of the Son to the Father by the power of the Spirit, which happened space and time on the cross 2,000 years ago, which is made present under the forms or appearances of bread and wine by the power of Christ acting through the ministerial priest. So all these things are brought together in the Eucharistic sacrifice. So it's very astute of you to see this twofold element there, but really the one sacrifice, the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, is what takes up or brings together all of the things that we bring to the Eucharist and gives them power and meaning and makes them capable of being a Christ-worthy sacrifice to the Father.
Mitch, I hope that that's helpful to you. Thank you so much for the question. We got to take a quick break, though, and we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
When I pray, there should be a change worked in me. Why? Because when I converse with God, I receive a part of God. That's the essence of prayer. But when I pray, I receive grace. I share in God's own life. I'm conversing with God. You never converse with God that you don't share God. What does prayer do? It pours living water into your heart. Why? Because I am conversing with the Holy One.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. We've got a free ebook we want to give you. It's about the Inquisition and the Crusades. These are sticking points for many people when they think about the life of the Catholic Church. Many Catholic people not sure what to make of this whole Inquisition and Crusades thing. If you'd like to get the real story of the Inquisition and the Crusades, it's available now at shop.catholic.com for free as an ebook. The real story, actually, it's this in this order, the real story of the Crusades and the Inquisition at shop.catholic.com. Our guest this hour, Mark Brumley, he's the president of Ignatius Press. I don't know if they've got any free ebooks for you. That might just be a thing we do. I don't want to put Mark on the spot, but we give away free ebooks. Mark?
We do too sometimes. People are invited to go to ignatius.com and check out our ebooks. That's Ignatius, Ignatius.com.
Yes.
How's that?
That's beautiful. Well done. Named after a saint.
After a saint. That's right. And you guys are named after a saint too, right? Saint Catholic?
Saint Catholic, yes. We are the beloved Saint Catholic. That's what we...
Hey, man, you got to give props to Carl Keating for securing Catholic.com.
What a brilliant move. Yeah.
Move on that part.
It is a brilliant move. Yeah. And it's so funny you or Patrick Madrid or some of the guys talk about how nobody knew what he was doing. I'm going to get this internet address. Like, okay, great. Get it.
Sure. Hey, whatever. Knock yourself out, Carl. Go get all the .coms you want, man.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There were the dime a dozen in those days. Robert in Tallahassee, Florida, watching on YouTube Live. You are next, Robert. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Oh, wow. Hey. So my question is, as someone who's struggling with their faith right now, especially pertaining to the resurrection, what's the most comprehensive set of books and like different resources that I can access that can help really like bolster in my faith and be able to defend it well?
Well, with respect to the specific issue of the resurrection, I recommend a book by Carl Olson. Carl is the editor of Catholic World Report, and the book is called Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? So I think that's an important book on the subject of resurrection. With respect to the historical background of Jesus, I mean, I mentioned that Jesus of Nazareth book by Michael Hesseman, Hesseman. There's also The Case for Jesus by Brant Petrie. Catholic Answers, you guys have a book. what's it called?
It's funny because I was just thinking I was going to send him Why You Can Trust the Gospels, but that's a
Why
DVD.
You trust.
But I don't think that's a book,
the,
though.
That's a DVD.
It's a DVD. From Jimmy
Aiken. It's a video.
Yeah.
Right. But you guys, I think you guys have, or at least you distribute,
on the resurrection. On why are we drawing a blank, Darren? Catholic Answers book on the resurrection. Do we have it? We're using that part of our brain that's called typing into the computer and searching right now.
That's right.
Robert. Why You Can Trust the Gospels, Jimmy Aiken's book, a DVD right. set. I'll send that to Robert.
Right. But I, of course, knew the Ignatius Press book, Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? I was able to boot that one up.
Yeah, and Carl Olson, you can do worse than Carl Olson and Brant Petrie, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But Brant Petrie's book on Jesus is a great book because it covers a lot of the historical facts, but it's written in a very accessible style. And so I highly recommend that.
Robert, you want to hang on the line and we'll get your address and we'll send you a copy of Jimmy's DVD set, Why You Can Trust the Gospels?
Oh, 100%.
All right.
Yeah, then, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Now, to make it 100%, I have to go slowly now. I got to put Robert on hold so I don't hang up on him when I go to Justin it says Idaho, Nampa, Idaho, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. Justin, is that correct? Are you in Nampa, Idaho?
Yes.
All right. Very good. We never know, but there it is, Nampa, Idaho. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
So I'm a former Jehovah's Witness, and I'm a truck driver by trade, so I go to Mass when I can. But I know that the Jehovah's Witnesses have had lots of legal issues with child molesters and sexual abuse, and they've not been very forthcoming. And I know the Catholic Church has had trouble in the past. So if someone's investing in the church like myself, how would you get peace of mind that things are going in the right direction.
Okay, thanks, Justin.
Well, I mean, I think that we have to keep, you know, ourselves informed to see what church leadership is doing. And I think over the last 20 years, we've seen huge reforms in the church, you know, even holding cardinals in the Catholic Church responsible. We know, you know, the Cardinal McCarrick story. There's a lot of evil that he was able to get by with for any number of years. But, you know, in the end, he was exposed and he was held accountable and was not only removed from the College of Cardinals, but was actually removed from the clerical state. And so I think things like that, we need to be aware of those things because they give us confidence that this is an issue that's being addressed. But, you know, it isn't just about what the leaders do. We certainly need – that's important. And ultimately, they have a responsibility before God and before the faithful to take care of these things. But all of us have a responsibility. So we need to be praying for our leaders and for our priests, and we need to be witnessing by – respectfully but firmly holding them accountable in the public sphere to remain faithful to what Christ asked of the church when it comes to these sexual scandals and sexual misconduct. So there's no easy formula. It requires prayerful diligence and support for leaders when they do the right thing, respectful criticism when they don't do the right thing. And just continue to hold ourselves accountable as individuals and hold the leadership of the church accountable. This is not – I mean, it's terrible what's happened in the last 40 years, but in the history of God's people, whether we're talking about the New Testament and the church or we're talking about before that, the Old Testament people of God, the covenant people of Israel, we've had scandals and sin exist in the church. So in that sense, it's not new. But the fact that it's not new doesn't mean it's acceptable. So we have to not allow ourselves to be scandalized in the sense of losing faith or losing hope or losing charity because of these things. But on the other hand, not to just accept them, oh, well, that's just the way human beings are. No, this is unacceptable, and we need to call people to the standard of the gospel. So that's what I would say.
What do you think, Jason? Justin. Go ahead.
Sure.
So – If there's a concern or misconduct in your local parish that you go to,
yes,
what would you recommend? I mean, I would it doesn't happen, of course.
Right. I would recommend going to the diocese, to the bishop of the diocese. And I will have to say, although in the past, 20 years ago and before, some bishops, many bishops, did not handle allegations of sexual misconduct by their clergy well or appropriately. As far as I've been able to see, and I've looked at it very closely over the last 20 years, in general, the church leadership, bishops have improved immensely. So I think if you were to see something or become aware of something that's going on in your parish, I think you should take it directly to the bishop of the diocese. And they usually have groups, organizations, and individuals whose responsibility it is to investigate these things.
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Justin. God bless you out there on the road as you're driving the truck, and maybe we'll get to talk with you again sometime. It's Open Forum with Mark Brumley, our guest. Open Forum means you can ask any question you'd like about the Catholic faith, and I didn't say this yet, and I should have. You don't have to be Catholic to call. You don't have to be Christian to call. We're happy to talk about the Christian faith, about Jesus, about the Bible, the sacraments, the Pope. Whatever you want, whether you're Catholic or Christian or not, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We're going now to Lee in Colorado, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Lee, go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I know in the Bible, many places of antiquity, wherever the Bible has said that there were cities that obviously were not there anymore, when they actually dug, they actually found archaeologically that the Bible was like fail safe as far as like locating those things. My question is, but there's structures like, you know, the Sphinx, and a recent archaeological find over in Turkey, the Göbekli Tepe. It's an old, supposedly a temple complex with massive stones and things that they carbon dated back to at least 10,000 years ago. And my question is some of this stuff that we see, is this pre-Antediluvian remains?
Oh, yeah, right. Okay,
are we looking?
Well, you can probably hear the music, Lee, so we're going to have to get you an answer on the other side of the break. But does some of this stuff predate the flood? We'll find out from Mark Brumley when we come back right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, decluttering.
Is your life cluttered up with problems you're tired of dealing with? We're going to help you clean house.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Groovy music there from Mark Brumley. The old groovy music from Mark Brumley. It's Open Forum. Mark is the president of Ignatius Press, here to answer your questions about the Catholic faith. If you got a question about the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884. Before we went to the break, Mark Lee in Colorado was asking about, there are very, very ancient religious structures, temples, and he mentioned the Sphinx, but you could go all around the world and find very, very ancient things that far predate the Bible. So Lee's question was, is this stuff surviving from before the flood?
Since we don't know when the flood was exactly, it's very difficult to say. So I would be inclined to say no, that these things are all within relatively speaking recent history, and that the flood is this very, very ancient phenomenon or event.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
What do you think, Lee?
But we don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's all speculation. I guess one day we'll find out. Could I ask one more really quick question?
I hope you will, because I love the archaeology angle, and I want you to, yes, go ahead. Give us another good one.
Have you ever heard of a manuscript that was written by Pontius Pilate to I think, Tiberius, called Acta Pilate? Pilate, and in this, it was a report that he wrote to Tiberius about his experience with what happened in Jerusalem with Jesus. And it was it's a fascinating report because it's probably like 10, 12 pages long. And in it, he actually mentions that he had Jesus called and had him brought into the Praetorium pre-Passover week to talk with him and to try to tell him that, you know, I believe in what you're doing, whatever, you know, well, I don't know who you are.
I'll tell you what, Lee, let's let Mark address whether he's heard of it first. And also, if you could address its authenticity, Mark.
Yes, of course, I've heard of it, and it's what we call an apocryphal work, which means it's a work that is not part of the biblical canon. And usually the word apocryphal has a connotation that it lacks not just authenticity in the sense of being part of the canon of the Bible, but is historically questionable or not reliable. Now, those are not the same things. Something can be apocryphal and be historically reliable, or be historically reliable, you know, as most of ancient history in that part, but not an apocryphal writing. Apocryphal here being associated with the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition, scriptural books and things of that sort. So this document is generally not regarded as having historical reliability or being authentically written by Pilate to Tiberius, but rather as something that was written later on to reflect the Christian tradition or Christian ideas about Jesus.
Lee, thank you for both of those questions. And I thought we might be heading towards archaeology, because Lee started out with kind of a description of how modern archaeology has found quite a bit that is quite supportive of the Gospels and of the Exodus, for example, more and more evidence for some kind of Exodus. But he didn't go that direction, so I was all excited.
And of course, we sometimes take for granted things that could very easily, as a function of history, have been lost to us. And then skeptical people would have said, well, you know, the Bible says this, but where is that? Something as simple as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Now, as it happens, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem survived the vicissitudes of history, but it might very well not have. And we might very well have had to deal with people who would have said things like, well, you know, this is legendary.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really have, you know, we have ancient sources that speak of it, but, you know, are those reliable? Are they just reflecting, you know, a legendary milieu or whatever? Some of the very things that are said now about certain events in the Bible or certain elements of the Bible that we don't necessarily have the same level, or in some instances wouldn't have any corroboration for, but other things we don't have the same level of corroboration for. Sometimes people will raise this as an objection, but we really really shouldn't expect everything that happened in the biblical, in those portions of the Bible that are giving us history. Now, say that not everything in the Bible is intended to be a historical account. So we have to keep that in mind. We don't want to object to Jesus's telling the parable of the Good Samaritan on account of the fact that we haven't been able to identify somebody called the Good Samaritan, right? That's obviously a parable, although for all we know, may have been based on a historical person. We don't know. There are plenty of things in the Bible that things that are historical, and that there's historical evidence for, and there's historical corroboration for. But what we don't want to do is say, well, unless there's historical corroboration or verification or something, that we can't give it any historical credence.
Yeah.
So I'm an enthusiast about biblical archaeology and those things that point to and corroborate the historical elements of the Bible. I think those are great. But I'm a little bit I don't want to rely too much on that because I don't want to convey the idea that unless something can be historically verified, it's therefore up for grabs or we can question it. So I guess the other extreme is to take a fideist position to say, well, it doesn't matter you know, the Bible says it, I believe it, and that settles it.
Right.
Well, there's you need a little bit more, especially when you're trying to make an apologetical case for something. So yeah. The truth is, as is often the case, it's somewhere in the middle. So.
Still, I find it really fun when they find things like Ezekiel's tunnel of Siloam and then the pool of Siloam, because you have in the second book of Kings, Ezekiel dug this tunnel. It's lost for thousands of years, and then they find it. And right where you would expect to look for it. And it dates to the right time. It dates to the Hezekiah.
Hezekiah, right.
And then the Pool of Siloam, Jesus healing the man in the Pool of Siloam. It describes the porticos and everything. And then for 1,500 years, well, there's no pool with porticos. It doesn't exist. And then they dig it up, and there it is, right at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel. So I love when that stuff happens, because you do get the feeling of, I don't know. I don't have Christian Schadenfreude. But I'm willing to have Christian Schadenfreude.
Right. Well, so when you talk about Hezekiah's tunnel, like where he talks about that in you know, the book of Hezekiah, right?
I'm pretty sure it's not in the book of Hezekiah. I've never seen that book, as a matter of fact.
When you said Ezekiel, I didn't want to say anything, but I was trying to find a segue and say, is that in the book of Hezekiah as a little cue? But you corrected yourself. Yeah. So.
No, but I mean, I'm sorry, but this is a very modern prejudice, but Hezekiah, Ezekiel, it starts to all sound the same after
a
while.
Sound the same.
I probably shouldn't have said that out. I know, right. But, you know, it's sometime 1,000 years from now, people will be like John and Joe, and all those names sound alike to me, you know. But
back in the day. All right.
Back in the day. All right. Sorry about my Christian Schadenfreude. Let's go to our next caller. We're going to I didn't say thank you to Lee. Lee, thank you very much for getting us off on archaeology and biblical archaeology, and call back again sometime. Monica is in Texas. She's listening on 89.7 FM. Monica, thanks so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi. My question is about indulgences. I received a card that had prayers on it, and they're very short prayers, but next to the prayer, it has 500 days, 10 years, 3 years, 7 years, like different times, you know, for each prayer that you say, I guess, of an indulgence that you receive.
Yep.
So my question is, who knows those days, and where did y'all get those from?
Well, I'm going to let Mark answer that, but first of all, do the 10 years one. I mean, all those other ones.
I do it all the time.
I'd go for the 10 years. Well, 500 days. Well, just shoot, go right for the 10 years. But Mark, what do you make of that?
Well, so these are kind of holdovers from an earlier time of, and they're not conveying time off in purgatory. What they're trying to convey is the notion that there were penances assigned, and those penances were assigned for a period of time. So as a way of expressing your sorrow for sin, you know. So you might pray a prayer for 500 days. You might pray a prayer for 10 years. You might pray a prayer for a certain period of time. But that we shouldn't think of purgatory as if it were simply earthly time extended into eternity. The idea of purgatory, when we talk about purgatory, we're talking about the purification of the heart of a person in relation to God, someone who is fundamentally in communion with God and God's friendship in the state of grace, as we say, but who has unrepentant venial sins or repented of mortal sins, but the person has not really adequately or completely repented in the sense of having wholly turned or transformed his life by God's grace away from that sin. So there's some attachment to sin, some undue attachment that remains after death. And so the person is in need of turning away from that, and there's a purgation. When we turn away from that to which we are inordinately attached towards the one to whom we should be completely attached, God, there's a death to self and a kind of suffering that turning away involves. And because that suffering that's involved in that turning away from some undue, some attachment that we still have towards God, there's a suffering involved, but it's not eternal. It's for a time, and therefore we say it's temporal. We call it a kind of temporal consequence or a temporal punishment due to sin. And so those penances were, when you're given a certain penance for time, the idea was, well, you are undergoing this penance for a period of time in this world in order to prevent or minimize or reduce the amount of time or temporal punishment due in purgatory. But we want to underscore that this is describing a reality. There is a reality of purgatory. There is a purgation that happens. And that purgation can be mitigated by things that we do in this life by God's grace. But we're using a lot of figurative language or picture talk language to express those ideas. And so the time off in purgatory or the years of penance associated with a certain time off in purgatory, that's a figurative way of conveying the reality that we need to undergo, that if we leave this world with unrepentant venial sin and not adequately repented of mortal sin, but we leave in the state of grace, that we will need to be purified in order to wholly and completely, purely be in full communion with God in the life of heaven.
How's that for you, Monica?
That was good.
Okay, good.
All right,
good. Very apparently good. You're funny as well, Monica.
Yeah, it was funny, wasn't it?
All right, we got to take a break. Monica, thanks for the call. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
I'm Roy Brown, Executive Director for Billings Catholic Radio. Catholic radio is arguably the greatest tool for evangelization. Radio has the power to speak directly to individuals and creates a sense of one-on-one fellowship. There is no better way to evangelize than through a relationship where we can share and bring the love and joy of Christ to another's daily life.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Here at Catholic Answers, we do apologetics, and I don't mention this enough, but there is a book called The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics that will help you avoid the most serious mistakes that budding apologists make. And I often introduce him as the president of the Alpha Quadrant's most important publishing house, Ignatius Press. But he's also the author of Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, our guest this hour, Mark Brumley. Sorry that I have neglected to mention that. I now suddenly am of the opinion that people's books should be mentioned a lot.
Why is that, I wonder?
I've developed that feeling about things. I don't know. Like, if someone's got a book, doggone it, mention it all the time.
Just can't mention it enough.
Can't mention your... all right, let's go to John in Portland, Oregon, listening on Mater Dei Radio. The matriarch of Catholic radio stations in the United States, one of the oldest and most important. John, go ahead with your question.
My question is about books that might be available through Mark's company for preparing children for First Eucharist. I have a goddaughter, and with the COVID pandemic and all that, and people's lives being broken up, there's highly unlikely that she's going to be joining a group of children at one of the churches for a First Eucharist celebration.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what we're looking for is...
Well, has she read Ratzinger's Introduction to Christianity, first of all? I'm sorry, I'm only kidding, John, because that's a really hard book. What do you got for him, Mark?
Well, as you mentioned Ratzinger, pardon me? What'd you say, John?
I said she couldn't even pronounce the word Ratzinger.
How about Benedict? Can she say Benedict? Well, you mentioned him. We actually have a book that – say that again, please.
I said she might associate that with eggs.
Oh, eggs, oh, yeah. Benedict. We actually have a book no problem. You mentioned Ratzinger. Benedict XVI did a book called Friendship with Jesus, which is he talks to children about Holy Communion. And then his successor, Pope Francis, we have a book by him called Your First Holy Communion, Meet Jesus, Your True Joy. So those are children's books. You know, obviously they've been adapted from things that the popes have written. It's not like the Pope sat down and wrote these books out themselves, but they have wonderful, wonderful illustrations, and they convey the teaching of the Church on the Eucharist. We also have a book called My First Holy Communion. So I highly recommend that, and that's by Deidre Mary Askoff. People can get these books at Ignatius.com. Or their local Catholic bookstore. We always encourage you to go there first. I know that's a challenge sometimes for people in COVID tide, but as we're coming out of COVID tide, check out your local Catholic bookstore first. And then another thing I would recommend, you know, in association with First Holy Communion, children usually get the first confessions, and we have a little book, a book called Little Book About Confession for Children. So I want you to check those out as well. And those things you can get, as I say, at your local Catholic bookstore. You can check them out at Ignatius.com.
Okay, John?
Okay, I'm on your site right now, and there appears to be a set called Sacramental Prep for First Communion.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Does this guy work for you? John, do you currently work for Ignatius Press? Are you...
No, but I'm a member of St. Ignatius Parish here in Portland.
All right.
Oh, well, good. Glad to hear that.
Does it get my foot in the door?
Yeah. That's right. You're not a shill, in other words. You're not a plant.
No.
No, but I think it's beautiful. You're a godfather, and you're concerned about your goddaughter, and God bless you for that. That's magnificent. So what about that set, sacramental preparation?
I think those are good resources. I would highly encourage you to check those out. You might also check out some of the video resources that are available, especially on digital platforms like Formed. Form.org has wonderful video resources for children in relation to sacramental prep. So
thanks, John.
All those things.
Thank you very, very much. Because we're getting near the end, I'm going to keep moving, and I want to go to Sven in Florida, listening to EWTN Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Sven, thanks for calling. You got a question for Mark? Sven?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Yes. Hi. Hello. I appreciate your program. I really enjoy your program. Thanks for taking my call. My question to you is about recently. Hello.
Oh yeah. Go ahead, Sven. Yes. We're listening.
We're here.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Is recently an. I actually really appreciate that. I noticed that there's been a lot of teaching lately about Satan and the power of Satan. And I think that's a lot of times something that we're a little bit reluctant to think about.
Yeah.
You know, we sort of brush it off a lot of times. And I had one of these moments when I was reading the scripture, and I read the same thing 1,000 times, and just something just hit me like a ton of bricks when I was reading about Christ when he was in his fasting in the desert for 40 days. And when he spoke to Satan and when Satan spoke to him and he responded back. And, you know, like I said, I read the same thing 1,000 times, and then I just went into real deep thought about this, because he said to Christ, he said, he took him to a high place and showed him, you know, the kingdoms of the world and so forth, and said, I can give you all these things if you will only bow down and worship me.
Right.
And then the response that Christ gave was, that away from me, Satan, that you will only worship, it is written, only you worship only the Lord your God and him only.
Right. So Sven, I'm really getting anxious that we're going to hit the end of the show. So do you want to just put it in the form of a question for Mark?
Yeah. Sure, I will. I think that Satan has a sort of a territorial dominion in this world that we just a lot of times just don't think about. And I think that's why Christ didn't say, that's not true, Satan, you know, that God possesses all things, and that is a lie, and you are not, you have no authority, or you have no dominion over these things.
He didn't say that.
All things are created by my Father in heaven, who is...
Well, okay, so let me get Mark to just comment on it, and I'll come back to you if we have time, Sven. But the fact that Jesus doesn't say to Satan, you can't give me the world, he answers differently. Does that suggest the dominion that Satan has in this world?
Yeah, and of course, in the context here, the world, by the world, we don't just mean the created order. It's not like Satan is in charge of the created order. Specifically, it's talking about the kingdoms of this world. In other words, it's not talking about the geographical regions. It's talking about the minds and hearts of people in the governing power of the world. And oftentimes, those folks, not limiting things to those folks, but those folks are concerned with what? Power and control and money and privilege, and they often engage in injustice and exploitation and things of that sort. And in that way, they're under the dominion of the devil. They're under the power of Satan. It is true that there's a real sort of spiritual dominion that people can be under when it comes to the devil. Ultimately, though, God is in charge. God has authority over the whole of creation. He allows Satan to be able to do certain things, because God has allowed freedom, a certain amount of freedom, and he wants to bring about good out of allowing even the abuse of freedom by the devil and the abuse of freedom by human beings, and he's able to do that. But we should never think that because the devil has real power in the world, and he controls his influence over people's minds and hearts, and he can have influence over us if we let him, that somehow that puts him on par with God. You know, you often see this idea that you've got God on the one hand, you have Satan on the other, and it almost looks like we have equal but opposite power. We have God on the side of good and Satan on the side of evil, but they're not equal. They are opposites, but they're not equal. You know, I think C.S. Lewis made the point that if there's a opposite parallel to Satan, it's Saint Michael the Archangel. It's not God. God is all powerful, and he is in no way is Satan even in his league. So to the extent that he's in a league, he's in the same league as Michael the Archangel, that they're angelic beings with finite power, finite abilities, and so on. And God ultimately is, although through Jesus' death and resurrection, he has triumphed over the devil, God is going to ultimately ratify that at the end of history. So we don't need to be afraid of the devil.
Sven, thank you very much. And St. Michael the Archangel, he does protect us in battle
he does.
From the wickedness and snares of the devil.
Yep. And may God rebuke him.
We humbly pray. That's right. Mark Bromley is the president of Ignatius Press, the author of 7 Deadly Sins of Apologetics, and just a great guy to get to spend a Thursday afternoon with. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Likewise. God bless you.
I hope we get to do it a million more times together.
At least.
Tomorrow, guess what we're going to do? We're going to just hit you with a bonus of 2 more hours of open forum because it's just gone so well. So we got Jimmy Akin coming back. He's going to do 2 hours of open forum. Ask him anything you want when we come back, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.